Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
It was a long time since the bustler had been so silent. She lay in the Sirian spaceport, her tubes cold, her shell particle-scarred, her air that of a long-distance runner exhausted at the end of a marathon. There was good reason for this. She had returned from a lengthy trip, by no means devoid of troubles. Now, in port, well-deserved rest had been gained, if only temporarily. Peace. Sweet peace. No more bothers, no more crises, no more major upsets, no more dire predicaments such as crop up in free flight at least twice a day. Just peace. Ah!
I don't know if we've had a sarcastic laugh like that in an opening reading before, although it's definitely been merited.
Yeah.
But that laugh wasn't just editorial from today's reader.
No.
It was actually in the text. Whose sultry voice was that, by the way?
Oh my gosh, that's our reader, Greg Johnson.
So glad to have Greg back. And we often tell folks to check out Greg's YouTube page when he does the show, but he's got more than that going on right now, doesn't he?
He does indeed. He's got his own Patreon page that's going on. He's doing maker videos. For instance, he has made a Bith mask, you know, the cantina guys from Star Wars. He made two of them.
Oh, cool.
For my birthday party. So I'm in the video because he talks about my birthday party. He made their instruments. He shows you how to make all this stuff, and he's got, it's very calming, very soothing. I watched a few maker videos anyway, and I think Greg totally nails it, just like he nails all the stuff he does. He's so talented. Yeah. I love it. Please go check out his stuff. It's really good. And if you like it and you want him to keep doing it, throw him a little cash.
We'll link out in the show notes so you can reach out and support Greg on Patreon, just like you are supporting us now here on Patreon. Mm-hmm. We are, of course, Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. You are joining us for our month of science fiction.
It's a star field of dreams here at Strange Studies. Electric dreams and caviar lasers. We're covering some classics of the genre, although it's a genre that's not always easy to define. You know, like, I loved Star Wars growing up, so I thought, sure, I'm a science fiction fan, but is that science fiction? Mm. It's more of a fantasy or mythology story.
Yeah. Space fantasy, space opera, sometimes people refer to it.
I think space opera is pretty good. But somebody who likes Return of the Jedi isn't necessarily going to spark to the foundation by Asimov. Speaking of, Asimov at one point wrote, science fiction can be defined as that branch of literature which deals with the reaction of human beings to changes in science and technology. So that's a no on Star Wars there. Robert Heinlein wrote that a handy short definition of almost all science fiction might read, realistic speculation about possible future events based solidly on adequate knowledge of the real world, past and present, and on a thorough understanding of the nature and significance of the scientific method.
Wow.
Again, a more pure definition of the genre. The author Damon Knight summed up the difficulty in defining science fiction, saying, science fiction is what we point to when we say it, which is probably the best definition. I know that the streamers categorize science fiction in some pretty stretchy ways. You know, just looking right now at Amazon Prime, in the science fiction category, we have Snowpiercer. Okay. But I'm also seeing like Earth Girls Are Easy, Hot Tub Time Machine, Alone in the Dark with Christian Slater.
Oof.
Do these meet the criteria of realistic speculation about possible future events?
They do not.
Let's go through this story, and at the end, we can decide if it is actually science fiction or not. It has a futuristic outer space setting, so that's a good start. What about our author?
We've never covered Eric Frank Russell on our show before.
No, I've seen his name in the pages of Weird Tales, so I know he wrote horror as well as science fiction.
Yeah. Russell was born in 1905 in Berkshire, England. When he was a teen, he was, of course, into the pulps.
Yes.
And while living in Liverpool, he saw a letter in Amazing Stories from a guy who also lived in Liverpool. His name was Leslie J. Johnson. They became friends, wrote a novella together called Seeker of Tomorrow, which was published in the July 1937 issue of Astounding Stories.
Nice.
His first novel, Sinister Barrier, was published in Unknown in the year 1939, which was Astounding Stories' sister magazine, but for fantasy. Sinister Barrier was heavily influenced by Charles Fort. Now, you know Charles Fort is the guy that Andrew Lehman played in Whisper in Darkness.
Is that how people know who Charles Fort is now?
Yes.
That man played by Andrew Lehman?
Yep.
Well, we've mentioned before on the show that Fort was an American writer who was interested in the occult and mysterious phenomena, the paranormal, secret conspiracies, And his theories actually influenced a lot of Russell's work throughout his career.
His second novel was serialized in Astounding Stories in 1948 called Dreadful Sanctuary. Ooh. It was a conspiracy story. Russell also served in World War II, supposedly in the RAF, but in a 1986 foreword of Russell's novel Wasp, it says he was too old for service and he was actually part of military intelligence in London, saying Russell spent the war dreaming up nasty tricks to play on the Germans and Japanese, including Operation Mincemeat.
Sounds delicious. What was that?
And if you don't know about Operation Mincemeat, it was a big deal. It was a successful British intelligence plan to hide the invasion of Sicily. It was a misdirect. So basically what they did, this is crazy, they found a dead homeless guy. I guess supposedly he ate some food that had rat poison in it and it killed him. So they dressed him up in a Royal Marines uniform and put fake plans on him. And these plans said that the Allies were going to invade Greece. Okay. So the dum-dums found the body, got the plans, the Axis powers, those dum-dums. And they thought it was true. So they moved all their forces over to Greece. And then wham, the Allies came in and took Sicily. Ha!
Boy, there's a lot of sarcastic laughs on the show today. That's a really crazy plan, and even more crazy that it worked. That book, Wasp, that you referenced from 1958 is maybe Russell's most famous work outside of today's story. There's a nice essay about the book by our friends at Tor.com that I can link to. In the introduction to that article, it says, "The espionage tale Wasp is a compelling story whose movie rights have been optioned twice without ever being filmed. The first was by Ringo Starr, and the second time by author Neil Gaiman in 2001. The plot: can one man stand against an entire planet? You might not think so until you consider the fact that a tiny wasp can distract a driver and cause him to destroy his vehicle. Wasp demonstrates the type of havoc that a well-trained agent can unleash behind enemy lines and illustrates the tactics of irregular warfare in a way that is as informative as any textbook. In portraying many of the tactics of irregular warfare, however, the book also takes us into morally dubious territory, a fact made even more clear in the wake of recent events, and I assume that's a reference to the events of 9/11.
All right, yeah. Back to Russell. He took up full-time writing in the late 1940s, and he won his first Hugo Award in 1955 with this story.
Alamagusa.
Now, Russell died in 1978 at the age of 73. Hmm. And his 1962 novel, The Great Explosion, won a Prometheus Hall of Fame Award in 1985, after his death, obviously. He was also put into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame in 2000.
His body? His frozen body was put into the Hall of Fame?
They put him in carbonite, yeah.
And then
he's just up on the wall there. So,
wow.
It's pretty cool. This story was first published in the May 1955 issue of Astounding Science Fiction, edited by, again, John W. Campbell.
As I mentioned last week, I had read The Cold Equations by Tom Godwin in preparation for this month. We're not covering it, but it really bummed me out. So when I read that this one was kind of funny, I went for it fast, and I really loved it. So let's just get into it.
The space fleet ship, the Bustler, is docked. The crew is out on shore leave, leaving just a few people on board. One of those people is Captain McNaught. He's chillaxing on board until the first officer, Gregory, returns that evening so that he can go out to the spaceport and party.
That was the beauty of making landfall at long last. Men could give way to themselves, blow off surplus steam, each according to his fashion. No duties, no worries, no dangers, no responsibilities in spaceport. A haven of safety and comfort for tired rovers. Again. Ha! That's what it says in the text.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That laugh. We all know as humans living life that it is in these restful moments that things often do go wrong. Just when you think you're done with work for a while, the house floods or the doctor calls. It's an ironic laugh.
Now, as the captain's on grinder or whatever, the chief radio officer, Berman, comes in and he's got a message from command. It says,
Terran headquarters to Bustler. Remain Siriport pending further orders. Rear Admiral Vane W. Cassidy due there 17th.
In the intro, this was called the Sirian spaceport. I thought maybe it was Earth.
No.
It says his 400 crew are making whoopee under a brilliant sun, making the rounds of neon-lit civilization. I was like, did Siri take over the digital assistant from Apple? But probably this is a reference to the star Sirius, which is, the brightest star we can see on Earth. And this is in the Sirius system, which isn't too far from our solar system, galactically speaking. Yeah. It's a neighbor. This is a spacefaring civilization of the future. So this is a different settlement with a city in it and everything. It says in the intro, no more dire predicaments such as crop up in free flight at least twice a day. So just like our story last week, space travel is tough. and depends on a lot of little things not going wrong. It's a very dangerous business. It's good to get a break. But now this message from the Rear Admiral.
Turns out that Rear Admiral Cassidy is also the head inspector of ships and stores. And inspections are no joke. Despite their spotless record, their time has come to get inspected. Now, the captain calls in the second officer, Pike, and he tells them that they have to call everybody back and get to work. The men won't like this, remarked Pike feebly. They're gonna love it, McNaught asserted. A bright and shiny ship all spick and span is good for morale. It says so in that book. Get moving. We've got to check the stocks before Cassidy arrives. Once he's here, we'll have no chance to make up shortage or smuggle out any extra items we happen to find in our hands. Now, like I said, these inspections are a big deal. A shortage of any item would be serious unless covered by a previous report. A surplus would be bad, very bad. The former implied carelessness or misfortune. The latter suggests a barefaced theft of government property in circumstances condoned by the commander. They gotta make sure everything is as it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
He talks about a commander that got busted for having too many coils of electric fence wire.
It had taken a court-martial to decide that the extra reel of electric fence wire, which had formidable barter value on a certain planet, had not been stolen from space stores or, in sailor jargon, teleported aboard. But Williams had been reprimanded, and that did not help promotion. Even though he wasn't up to contraband, he still got reprimanded. This is a serious military operation, space travel. It's got to be very precise, and it's probably pretty annoying that you can't pick up souvenirs on your travels if you are a spacer, but considering how dangerous everything is, you know, these inspections, I'm sure, serve a very good purpose, however annoying.
Pike has all the paperwork ready to go, and the captain doesn't want to waste any time, so they're off to do inventory. But on the way, they run into Peaslake, the ship's dog. He was a large dog whose ancestors had been more enthusiastic than selective.
What's a drive-by on his, on his family?
He wore with pride a big collar inscribed Peaslake, property of SS Bustler. His chief duties, ably performed, were to keep alien rodents off the ship and, on rare occasions, smell out dangers not visible to human eyes. And I was like, ah, oh, I love the implications of this.
Yeah, maybe it would be that he smells out a gas leak or something, but it also could be, as we've had on the show, some kind of invisible monster. And even though I love good sci-fi babble, I thought that was much more suggestive the way he did that there than if it said, you know, like the gaseous creatures from Fartron 3. Didn't need to say Fartron 3. Yeah,
he didn't. The captain, Pike, and the dog, they head to the bridge. The captain reads out what's supposed to be there, and Pike checks to make sure it's all square.
This is Second Officer Pike. Is this the backstory for Captain Pike of Star Trek?
Yes, it is.
This is canon?
This is canon.
Wow.
As they go down the list, Gregory, the first officer, comes back, and the captain tells him that they need to get the whole crew back, and everyone is on the clock. No excuses.
The sheer amount of inventory that they're going to have to do, it's an all-hands-on-deck kind of situation. And you don't know anything about the story going in. You might wonder, what will they find in their stores? Is there alien goo? Is there a dangerous stowaway they might have to hide? That's what I thought after reading Cold Equations. What's going to happen here?
They work until evening, by which time three-quarters of the crew is back and they're hard at work.
Doing their jobs as those sentenced to them for crimes contemplated but not yet committed. They're not happy that they got pulled out of the bar to do this. There's a lot of really concise, funny writing in the story. It actually feels more like the funny stories about the service that veterans tell each other rather than a sci-fi story. There was this section of Reader's Digest that my dad loved called Humor in Uniform. And I think that section's still there. It's called Off Base now. But this feels like it would work perfectly there. A lot of those are about servicemen coming up with really unique ways to get out of trouble from superior officers.
Now, on the second day of inventory, there in the galley was Jean Blanchard, the ship's cook, and they hit a snag.
McNaught said, boredly, V1097, drinking bowl, enamel, one of.
Is this?
Said Blanchard, tapping it. V1098, off-og, one.
Qua?
Asked Blanchard, staring. V1098, off-og, one, repeated McNaught. Well, why are you looking thunderstruck? This is the ship's galley. You're the head cook. You know what's supposed to be in the galley, don't you? Where's this off-og?
Never hear of him, stated Blanchard, flatly.
You must have. It's on this equipment sheet in plain, clear type. Off-og 1, it says. It was here when we were fitted out 4 years ago. We checked it ourselves and signed for it.
I signed for nothing called off-og, Blanchard denied. In the cuisine, there's no such thing.
Look! McNaught scowled and showed him the sheet.
Blanchard looked and sniffed disdainfully. I have here the electronic oven, one of. I have jacketed boilers, graduated capacities, one set. I have Bain-Marie pans, six of. But no Offog. Never heard of him. I do not know of him. He spread his hands and shrugged. No Offog. There's got to be, McNaught insisted. What's more, when Cassidy arrives, there'll be hell to pay if there isn't.
By the way, I believe Blanchard is French.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Greg isn't just suddenly doing a funny accent or, you know, had a weird stroke. It's in the text.
It's written phonetically. The captain is annoyed that Blanchard doesn't know what an offhog is, and Blanchard is sure that it has nothing to do with cooking. But they signed off on it, so it must be there.
But Blanchard says, hey, I know it was recorded as being in the galley, but that doesn't mean it's kitchen equipment necessarily. That's just when you counted it in. Like, there's an intercom right there on the wall. I don't cook with that. So there's plenty of other technology in here.
Mm-hmm. So the captain thinks it might be a communications thing, since communications run throughout the ship. So maybe Berman will know what it is.
Berman, I guess, being the communications guy who handles all the ship's beepers.
It's the future, yeah.
They have beepers. Yeah.
They go to Berman and ask what the hell is an offog. He doesn't know.
Berman says, that sounds, you know, that's a pretty silly word. I don't know what that is, which makes McNaught kind of mad. He says, up in the bow, there's a direction and distance indicator. What do you call it? A didin, said Berman. And pointing at a pulse transmitter, what do you call that? Well, the opper popper. Baby name, see? Didin and opper popper. Now rack your brains and remember what you called an offog 4 years ago. Nothing, asserted Berman, has ever been called an offog to my knowledge. And I thought that was a pretty well-reasoned argument on McNaught's part, because yep. It's also kind of cool because so often pieces of high technology will have absurd names. Like, I made a beeper joke a second ago, but I could see somebody in the 1950s going, nobody's going to call that high-tech comm device a beeper. What a silly name. Or, wait a minute, you have a search machine of all the world's knowledge and you call it a Google? These are silly sure. words.
The captain knows he signed off on the offog 4 years earlier, but why would he sign off on something that he doesn't know what it is? They ask around to the other officers, but again, nobody's heard of this thing. Berman suggests just crossing it off the list, but that's not going to cut it. The captain gets an idea. Let's make one.
I mean, if this is just some stupid small piece of technology, so esoteric that nobody knows what it is, none of the specialists, they've clearly done lots of space travel not knowing what it is, so they must not really need it. And if nobody here knows what it is, then the inspector probably won't either, so let's paper over this problem. We don't want to say we don't have it, because for all we know, it might be valued at a $500,000, this contraption.
He tells Berman, make something, something we can call an offhog, and Berman asks why he has to do it. Because it's typical of the baby names used for this kind of stuff. I'll bet a month's pay that an offhog is some sort of scientific alamagooza. Something to do with fog, perhaps, maybe a blind approach gadget. The blind approach transceiver is called the Fumbly, Berman informed. There you are, said McNaught, as if that clinched it.
The Fumbly. Alamagooza, the title of the story, I think, is meant to be a word like thingamajig or widget.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a word that was in usage at the time. You get from context that that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I would love if Russell just made up alamagooza for this story. It's a future word. What, you know, what will people call thingamajigs in the future? That's a speculative question.
Yeah, there you go. So it is science fiction.
It is science fiction, I guess.
Berman wants to know how he can make something that he doesn't even know what it is, but the captain says, it's fine. Nobody knows what it is.
Let us use the brains that God has given us. Get a grip on your soldering iron and make a top-notch offhog by 6 tomorrow evening. That's an order. Don't just make up what it is. It better be the best at this made-up.
So the next day, Berman makes an offhog, and soon after, the Admiral arrives. Of course, this guy is a real hard ass. They go through the whole ship, checking the inventory.
The Admiral pauses when the dog trots up to him and examines a Peaslake's collar. Well cared for, I see. Has the animal proved useful? Well, he saved 5 lives on Mardia by barking a warning. The details have been entered in your log, I suppose. Yes, sir. The log is in the chart room awaiting your inspection. So I loved that. Even the dog's barks need to be accounted for. This admiral is definitely Ted Knight.
Yeah, he is. Finally, when they get to the galley, the offhog comes up. The captain tells the admiral that it's in the radio room, explaining that it's on the galley list because it connects to the galley. Then it should have been transferred to the radio room list. Why didn't you transfer it? I thought it would be better to wait for your authority to do so, sir. The fish eyes registered gratification. Yes.
That is quite proper of you, Captain. I will transfer it now.
Such a funny interaction. They know to appeal to the Admiral's vanity of his position in order to brush over it.
Now, the Admiral continues until they get to the radio room, and there is the Offog.
Moving with the jerkiness of a slightly uncoordinated robot, Berman pawed a small box fronted with dials, switches, and colored lights. It looked like a radio ham's idea of a fruit machine. He knocked down a couple of switches, the lights came on, played around in intriguing combinations.
A fruit machine.
Well, this is a weird device that they came up with. Yeah. This is an Offog.
And he really went for it. You know, it wasn't just a square box. It's got lights, it's got switches, it's got knobs.
It's just like something you might see on Greg Johnson's Patreon page.
Exactly. Now, of course, the Admiral doesn't recognize it, and he asks what it does. Hastily, McNaught said, a full explanation would be rather involved and technical, but to put it as simply as possible, it enables us to strike a balance between opposing gravitational fields. Variations in light indicate the extent and degree of unbalance at any given time. And this seems to placate the Admiral, so he moves on.
These guys are pretty good at managing this Admiral. And the writer is very good, you know, because very concisely from that previous Ted Knight interaction, he's characterized the Admiral.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in his vanity. Uh-huh. So we know the Admiral is not going to risk looking like he's not the smartest guy in the room. And when McNaught says, I'll put it as simply as possible, gobbledygooky dooky dooky. Mm-hmm. Well, he's not going to ask him questions about that because then it's going to reveal gaps in his knowledge. So he just accepts that Offog explanation. He's going to act like he gets it. Uh-huh. I see, said Cassidy, not seeing at all. He resumed his seat, ticked the Offog, and carried on. Victory had been gained. All was well for the third time. Ha!
Rear Admiral Bane W. Cassidy departed pleased and complimentary. They all relax, bullet dodged. On the sixth day, they get a report that the ship is to be recalled for overhaul and refitting. They're going back to Earth, and it means that the men actually get a month's time off while the ship is being refit. So they're going to be stoked about this.
Everyone was still grinning 2 weeks later when the sea report had receded far behind and Sol had grown to a vague speck in the sparkling mist of the bow starfield. 11 weeks still to go, but it was worth it. Back to Terra. Hurrah! It actually doesn't say Earth, but we assume Terra is Earth and Sol is the sun. But it means time off, like you said, so it's great.
Everyone's excited, but Berman is worried. He mentions to the captain that experts will be doing the overhaul. Experts that might know what an Offog is. So they gotta ditch it.
McNaught has a good suggestion. Break up the contraption and feed it into the disintegrator. Well, that doesn't solve the problem, said Berman. We'll still be short an Offog. McNaught says, no, we won't, because I'm going to signal its loss owing to the hazards of space service. He closed one eye in an emphatic wink, reached for a message pad, and scribbled on it while Berman stood by, vastly relieved.
The message he sends reads thus.
Bustler to Terran headquarters. Item V1098, Offog 1, came apart under gravitational stress while passing through Twin Sunfield, Hector Major Minor. Material used as fuel. McNaught, Commander. Bustler.
So yeah, he's saying, hey, it fell apart and we used it to move the ship. So that explains the absence.
Yeah, but 2 days later, they get this message.
Terran headquarters for relay all sectors. Urgent and important. All ships grounded forthwith. Vessels in flight under official orders will make for nearest spaceport pending further instructions. Welling, alarm and rescue command, Terra.
Uh-oh.
Well, this is serious. Something huge is going on to have the whole fleet freak out.
Every ship everywhere is going to be grounded. The last general call was 7 years ago when the Starrider exploded halfway along the Mars run. They grounded every ship in existence while they investigated the cause. So this must be like that.
Yeah. Berman thinks it might even be the start of a space war. But the captain quickly dismisses it. He says, nobody has the ships with which to oppose us. No, it's something technical. He orders Berman to get to the bottom of it. And 2 hours later, Berman is horrified by the response. It's the Offog. He finally knows what it is.
It's a typographical error. In your copy, it should read, Off Dog. The commander stared owlishly. Off Dog? Echoed McNaught, making it sound like foul language. See for yourself. Dumping the signal on the desk, Berman bolted out, left the door swinging. McNaught scowled after him, picked up the message. Terran headquarters to Bustler. Your report, V1098, ship's official dog, Peaslake. Detail fully circumstances and manner in which animal came apart under gravitational stress. Cross-examine crew and signal all coincidental symptoms experienced by them. urgent and important. Welling, Alarm and Rescue Command, Terra.
In the privacy of his cabin, McNaught commenced to eat his nails. Every now and again, he went a little cross-eyed as he examined them for nearness to the flesh.
And that's the end of the story. Off-period dog meant official dog. It was an abbreviation! My God, an abbreviation!
Oh, boy.
It makes one wonder, do they then go, well, we got to carve up that dog and feed it into the disintegrator. No. I don't think they did that.
No, they don't do that. Well, because obviously, if the dog just all of a sudden exploded, that could mean that there's some kind of weird entity, some space virus. You know, in Star Trek, when something affects a member of the crew, it affected the dog first. It could start happening to other people.
Of course, how many episodes of Star Trek kick off with the dog blowing up? I mean, like every other one. Oh, eight. There's an exact number.
Yeah. If you include the animated series, it's eight, which I did.
Okay. So. Yeah, sure. Well, that's the story. It's kind of a joke along.
It is.
You know, humor in uniform.
It's based off, or I don't know if it's based off of it, but there is this tale / urban myth called Shovewood. And it's about a seaman who takes over for the guy who usually keeps the ship's store. And he's looking at the list and he finds something called Shovewood on the list. The story of that is he just keeps going up the line. Mm-hmm. You know, to, you know, the guy above him and the guy above him to the captain and finally to the admiral of the fleet. And nobody knows where the Shovewood is. And finally, when he gets back to the store and the guy who normally runs the store comes in, he's like, what the heck is a Shovewood? He goes, oh, it's a wooden shovel. You know, what's the big deal?
It just sounded like it was more specific than it is. Yeah.
And that's kind of it. It was a really short, you know, it's only a few paragraphs. And I think it was might have been an old seaman's story.
Right.
You know, about how people on the lower levels have a system of the way things work, and the people on the upper levels, they don't really understand how that system works.
And it just shows how a little mistake in communication can really blow out of proportion.
Oh, yeah.
Is this science fiction then? By those earlier definitions? I think it is. Here we have something that doesn't meet any of those definitions. It's set in space, but is this about how technology is going to influence us in the future? I mean, to me, I think the story says the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah. To me, this feels like this almost exact story could be told set on a World War II vessel.
Right. And likely that it is a urban myth that got passed around during the author's service in that war, and he just set it in space. But it won a Hugo, so clearly the experts think it's science fiction.
Yeah, and it's good. It's funny. It's written really well. Like you said, it just communicates so much with so little, and it's a fast read, and it's funny.
It's funny, and it's rare that in the science fiction field you do get something that the purpose of it is just to make you chuckle. There is some speculative stuff in there in terms of here's what Earth is called now, here's what the sun is called now, but at the end of the day, I think it's about how humans are going to be the same in the future. And maybe that is the speculative part of it, that our natures don't change too much. We're still going to try and cover up for our mistakes or try to paper over things. I think here it does show again, as with our story last week, and I think in general I was saying a thing about science fiction, little things are so important because you are risking so much by leaving our home planet. Tiny mistakes matter. And here's just a different way to look at that same issue.
Yeah.
They ground, who knows what the implications of this decision are. There aid ships that just got grounded who aren't going to get food to people who need it because of this off-fog thing? Mm-hmm. I mean, are there going to be really vast consequences for this miscommunication?
Yeah.
Possibly.
I also want to point out just how amazing the space program was in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And the stuff that they were able, because, you know, any little thing could throw it off.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing complicated stuff with computers that were people. A thing called a computer then was a person. A person was a computer because they did the computations.
Right.
Like, that's not, you know, there was a picture of one of the women that worked at NASA. I forgot her name now. But they show a picture of all of her coding that she did, or all of the equations. And it's a stack of paper that's as tall as she is.
Yeah. Done by hand.
By hand. And if you make a mistake, you know, if you're off by a bit, they were able to get people to the moon and back. That is nuts.
Really crazy. It really is. And so I do think that this story takes a humorous look at that and how important every little thing is. It also reminded me of some other urban legends. There's the one where it's these baggage handlers who are supposed to deliver a woman's dog who's very important. And when they look in the carrier, the dog has died. And so they quickly rush out and buy a dog that looks just like it and put it in the carrier. And then when the woman receives the dog, it bounds out of the carrier and starts licking her face. And she has a heart attack because she was delivering a dead dog. Yeah. She didn't expect it to come back to life. So it reminded me of that story a little bit, which again is about baggage handlers trying to paper over a mistake.
Yeah.
And also there's another one that's very similar to that, where there's a woman who this was told to me as absolute fact, where there was a woman in New York who was caring for a friend's sick dog, while that person was on vacation, a hard-won vacation, didn't want to pay. There were so many needs for this dog that she had her good friend care for it. Well, the woman leaves on vacation and the caretaker finds that dog died like a day later and doesn't want to spoil this vacation. So I got to just deal with this, and calls the vet. And the vet says, if you bring the dog down here, we'll take care of it. And we'll even notify the owner that the dog has died. But it's New York and she doesn't have a car. So she's got to get this dog on the subway over to the vet's office.
Yes.
The only thing around, there isn't a carrier, throws the dog into a suitcase. The dead dog's in a suitcase. Goes down to the subway, and as she's walking down the stairs, a gentleman says, hey, can I help you with your suitcase? She says, yes. He takes the suitcase, and Jen runs off with it. He's a thief. And that's the end of that urban legend, because you can just imagine the thief opens up the suitcase to see what he's won, and he's stolen a dead dog. Amusing to me, maybe not to everybody, but I was at Thanksgiving last year with some of Heather's in-laws, and I was telling these stories, and they were killing. I told those two, one after the other. And then my mother-in-law piped up and she goes, well, I had a friend who boarded her cat with a vet's office. And then when she came back, they'd left the cat outside and it froze to death. And everybody was just quiet, just like you just were. Like, no funny twist.
That's just a terrible thing that happened.
It's just a terrible thing that happened. It made me laugh so hard because my mother-in-law, when she heard the two stories, she didn't go, oh, these are two jokes. She went, we're telling stories about dead animals. It's just how she scared. That is the perfect story to encapsulate her worldview. Wow. Which is, that to me was the best part of Thanksgiving when she did that. That's, I mean, just confusion and horror on the looks of all the people around the table. It was great. Well, I really liked this one. Thank you, Hugo, for awarding it something so that I could hear about it. We don't talk about Hugo enough.
No, he's done great stuff. Thanks, Hugo. And I want to thank our reader, Greg Johnson.
Please, folks, go check out his Patreon page if you want to learn how to make an offog. He might have a video there for you. I like how I just gave Greg a job.
Yeah,
he'll make one and send it to you if you want your own offog. I also want to thank some of our patrons who support us. They're great people, and I'm going to start by thanking Fire Every Time.
France Lee Hadrasak. She's read for us. She's my good friend.
Yeah.
I didn't know she sponsored our show. Thank you, France Lee.
Thank you so much, France Lee. Zippy Zito, thank you.
I'd like to thank Derek.
Christopher Collins, thank you so much.
Caleb Cotton, thank you.
Gary Smith, thank you.
I'd like to thank John Butler.
Gareth Davies, thank you.
Christopher R. Adams, thank you.
William Chachosky, thank you.
Derek Benson, thank you.
I'd like to thank Chad.
Do you patronize our show?
I do. I support our show.
Oh, wow.
Thank you, man. Somebody's got to help these guys. I'm super disassociative. I'm my own patron.
I'd like to thank Alan Wilkinson.
And finally, I'd like to thank Aaron Mullen. You guys are great. We're going to be back next week with more science fiction. In fact, we're going to be covering a story called Nobody Bothers Gus. And that's a little more on the, I don't know, superhero speculative fiction side of it. It's not an outer space story.
No.
We're gonna have lots to talk about there. So tune in for Nobody Bothers Gus. For now, I am Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.